Good afternoon.
This is one of the sessions of the Sunstone Conference. We're being broadcast on the radio on KCPW FM 88.3. This afternoon we are going to have one of our plenary sessions that's always held in the 3 o'clock hour Sunstone, devoted to one of the most pressing issues not only within the Mormon community, but within every serious religious community in the United States that I'm aware of. And particularly every serious religious community that operates religious colleges and universities. The delicate balance, the tension between academic freedom and the integrity necessary for academic life, and maintaining religious commitment at that institution. In the last 10 years, this discussion, this debate, the striving for this balance has divided universities and communities of faith across the land, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and many others have been divided and bedeviled by this problem, for which there may not be any one good or right answer. We thought that this issue was an appropriate issue to address at Sunstone. We thought it was important to address it in a broader context than simply that of BYU or Ricks College or BYU Hawaii or other church educational venues, because it is an issue that is broader than the Mormons, broader than one religious denomination or one religious college or institution. So we thought it was important to kind of get a broad view and then maybe make some more narrow comments that are more focused on the situation of Mormon higher education. To that end, we have brought in my good friend and one of the most well-versed individuals on the religious scene in America that I know. James Nuchterline is currently, and has been for the past 4.5 years, the editor of what is, I think, arguably, and in my estimation, it isn't even an argument, the best thought magazine in America, if not in the English-speaking world. First Things. If you haven't seen it, you definitely should see this. It's a journal devoted monthly to the relationship of religion and public life in America. It is published by the Institute on Religion and Public Life in New York City. Jim is a graduate of Valparaiso University with graduate work at Yale. From 1964 to 1981, he taught American history at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, and there became fast friends with one of our old Sunstone comrades, Klaus Hansen. Between 1981 and 1989, Jim was professor of American Studies and Political Thought at Valparaiso University, a Lutheran institution committed to the Lutheran Confession of Faith, in Indiana, where he was also editor of their journal, The Crescent, the university's journal of literature, arts, and public affairs. His articles on American political thought and culture and the relationship of religion to public life in America have appeared in such venues as The American Scholar, Commentary, Review of Politics, The Virginia Quarterly, The South Atlantic Quarterly. After Jim finishes speaking for perhaps half an hour, we are going to have two comments on Jim's talk. The first is going to be by Marty Bradley, currently, for the next, 2 weeks, professor of history at BYU. Many of you know that Marty has resigned her position at BYU, although they are trying mightily to get her to reconsider. But she has resigned over concern about the very issues that we are going to be addressing this afternoon. After Jim and Marty finish, I will try to make a few final comments, and then we will turn it over to you for your questions, your probing deliberation of these issues. And I hope if one thing we do this afternoon is show you that this is an issue on which there are many sides and much controversy. And I hope we can shed more light than heat on that controversy. Jim, this podium is yours. The radio audience is waiting.
Thank you, Richard. My topic is academic freedom and the religious university. And I want to get into it, and I hope illuminate it, by telling a story. Sometime in the late summer of 1988, when I was still on the faculty of Valparaiso University in Indiana, I received a call from the Washington headquarters of the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP. The official there wondered if I would be willing to serve on an AAUP investigating committee looking into a charge of breach of academic freedom brought against Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The AAUP official thought I would be an ideal person to serve on this particular case. Concordia Seminary is operated by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the LCMS. And Valparaiso University, although free of any official institutional affiliation with the LCMS, has, since 1925, when it was purchased by individual members of the Missouri Synod, considered itself a Lutheran University of Missouri Synod heritage. Moreover, I had just published an essay in the American Scholar, Athens and Jerusalem in Indiana, in which I had written sympathetically, if by no means uncritically, of my experience as both an undergraduate and later a faculty member at Valparaiso. The AAUP official, concerned that his organization was perceived by its critics as indifferent or unfriendly to religious sensibilities, thought that appointment of someone like me, a non-disaffected Lutheran, to a case involving a Lutheran institution would be evidence of the AAUP's good faith and disinterested intentions. My initial response was skeptical. I was not, in fact, as good an appointment for the AAUP's purposes as it thought. During the early 1970s, the LCMS had torn itself apart in a series of doctrinal conflicts that pitted conservatives against moderates. No one in Missouri would own up to being a liberal, with particular emphasis on the question of interpretation of the Bible. The conservatives, who insisted on a literal reading of Scripture, won decisively in a series of political fights at LCMS conventions that eventually resulted in an exodus of moderates from the synod. I had sided with the moderates and had said so in print. And despite my increasing discontent with the post-70s drift of the moderates toward general American Protestantism, I remained a critic of the conservatives. More particularly, I'd been involved in controversies with the majority faculty faction at Concordia Fort Wayne, which had established itself as champion of conservative orthodoxy within the LCMS. It was unlikely, in other words, that most members of the faculty at Concordia would accept me as an objective arbiter. But in the end, I relented. The AAUP's credibility did not particularly concern me one way or the other, but I did care about the larger issues at hand, and I concluded that I was in fact peculiarly situated, whatever the people at Concordia might think, to render a balanced judgment. The case involved a Professor X, a tenured full professor, who had been dismissed by the seminary for teaching false doctrine, specifically for contending, contrary to the official position of the LCMS, that there are no valid theological or biblical grounds forbidding the ordination of women as ministers. In addition to calling in the AAUP, Professor X had also sued the seminary for breach of contract. The suit was eventually settled out of court, But the AAUP's investigation went ahead, although the seminary refused from the outset to cooperate, insisting that the case was a matter of church doctrine that did not concern the AAUP. Upon investigation, the case turned out to be not as clear-cut on the issue of academic freedom for religious institutions as one might have hoped. There were, to begin with, as there so often are in such matters, questions of procedure. Professor X made a not unsubstantial case that the seminary had proceeded against him in ways that violated its own and the synod's own prescribed rules, not to mention the elaborate, bordering on Byzantine procedures called for in these matters by the AAUP. More significantly, though, it turned out that Professor X and the AAUP saw the case in quite different lights, as the final report of the investigating committee made clear. I should note here parenthetically, I had my name removed from the final report of the investigating committee and, in fact, issued a rather vehement dissent against it. I'm quoting, though, from the final official report. It is not within the purview of the investigating committee to pass judgment on the question of whether or not Professor X did in fact teach what the LCMS would consider to be false doctrine. Professor X himself does not claim an absolute right of academic freedom as a member of the theological seminary faculty, and indeed appears to accept the premise that, had he taught false doctrine, he deserved to be dismissed. From his point of view, the principal issue may be whether or not he was in fact teaching false doctrine. From the point of view of the AAUP, however, the concern is that the administration and the Board of Regents, in dismissing him because he expressed certain views in the classroom and in his writing that are within his area of academic competence, acted in violation of his academic freedom. The investigating committee finds that Professor X was indeed dismissed for reasons violative of academic freedom as enunciated in the 1940 Statement of Principles on Freedom and Tenure and generally accepted in American higher education. End of quote. Mention of the AAUP's 1940 statement draws us towards the center of the problem of the modern secular academy's attitude, as represented authoritatively by the AAUP, toward academic freedom in church-related institutions. The history of the development of that attitude is an illuminating and thoroughly depressing tale. The 1940 statement defends academic freedom for faculty members in three categories. One, freedom in research and in the publication of the results. Two, freedom in the classroom in discussing the professor's subject. And three, freedom from institutional censorship and discipline when professors speak or write as citizens. There is, however, one apparently straightforward exception in the document to applications of that freedom, and that's the so-called limitations clause. Quote, limitations of academic freedom because of religious or other aims of the institution should be clearly stated in writing at the time of appointment. Now, a common sense reading of that clause would suggest that restrictions on academic freedom for religious reasons are legitimate as long as they are plainly specified when faculty are hired. It would not seem to make sense, in other words, that a statement of rights of academic freedom specifying certain exceptions would suggest anything other than the legitimacy of those exceptions. And so it was in practice for a long period after 1940. In fact, as late as 1965, in a case involving Gonzaga University, a Jesuit institution, the AAUP's Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure, Committee A, ruled that, quote, satisfactory conditions of academic freedom and tenure now prevail at Gonzaga, unquote. This despite restrictions on all faculty members to, quote, be careful not to introduce into their teaching controversial matter which is contrary to the specified aims of the institution, end quote, and despite reserving to the university the right to dismiss non-tenured faculty for, quote, inculcation of viewpoints which contradict explicit principles of Catholic faith and morals. Yet it became clear within a few years thereafter, AAUP had begun to develop second thoughts on the question. In 1970, the association adopted a statement of interpretive comments on the 1940 document that included this sentence, quote, "Most church-related institutions no longer need or desire the departure from the principle of academic freedom implied in the 1940 statement, and we do not endorse such a departure," end quote. Read at face value, that somewhat curious sentence would suggest nothing more than a statement of observation and encouragement, that is, the AAUP observes that most church-related institutions no longer feel the need to take advantage of the limitations clause, and it supports that development. But note, however, that something further is going on here. The AAUP not only supports the trend away from restrictions on academic freedom allowed by the limitations clause, it refuses to endorse institutions that continue to take advantage of that clause. In other words, the original legitimacy of the limitations clause has now been brought into question, though without the clear repudiation of that clause that such a development would seem to call for. The process of implicit repudiation through reinterpretation continued in the report of a 1988 subcommittee of Committee A, the substance of which report defines current AAU policy. The subcommittee concluded that the 1970 interpretive comments, quote, repudiated not the limitations clause, but the interpretation of an acceptable or indulgent limitation. It follows then that an institution, quote, has no right under the 1940 statement simultaneously to invoke the limitations clause and to claim that it is an institution of learning to be classed with institutions that impose no such restriction. Observe the elaborate process of linguistic evasion at work here. One moves from an apparently dispassionate tautology, institutions of higher learning that invoke the limitations clause are different in classification from institutions that do not, to an evaluative judgment that repudiates invocation of the limitations clause, there can be no acceptable or indulgent limitation on academic freedom, even while the wording of the limitations clause remains intact. Thus, institutions that take advantage of an explicit dispensation in an official AAU statement are subject to disapproval and official censure for so doing. The process is nothing short of Orwellian. Religious institutions are informed that they have the continuing, quote, right, unquote, to impose restrictions on academic freedom. But it turns out that this is a right that cannot legitimately be exercised. For an institution to avail itself of it is to remove itself from the ranks of true institutions of higher learning. So it was with Concordia Seminary, which was added to the AAUP censure list in the case of Professor X. Now, the LCMS Statement of Limitations on Academic Freedom, which is included in the Concordia Faculty Handbook, could hardly be more clear or explicit. Quote, "Faculty members are pledged to the Scriptures as the inspired and inerrant Word of God and to the Lutheran Confession, and are also expected to honor, to uphold, and to teach in accordance with synodically adopted doctrinal statements, which express the convictions of the fathers and brethren, with whom all members of the synod are united in their obedience to the scriptures and the confessions," end quote. The seminary invoked that limit on academic freedom with respect to Professor X. That it may have done so inaccurately is not here relevant. The AAUP report solemnly acknowledges, quote, "the right of Concordia Theological Seminary to set limitations on what its faculty can write and say," end quote, but then immediately proclaims, quote, "that in so doing, the seminary separates itself from the community of higher education that holds academic freedom central to institutional integrity." It bears emphasizing that here as elsewhere, AAUP policy involves no mere exercise in neutral taxonomy, that is, division of the academic world into institutions that restrict academic freedom and those that do not. As in the Concordia case, those institutions that do operate with restrictions are visited by the AAUP with intellectual ostracism and academic sanctions. They are officially censured, and the rest of the academic community is in effect told that it should have no dealings with them unless and until they change their policies. The AAUP policy comes down to this. It requires of theological seminaries, and of course all other institutions of religious higher education, an unfair and intolerable choice. Legitimacy as institutions of higher education or sacrifice of their commitments to confessional loyalty. The association has sufficient residual decency that it's uneasy with what it has done. So it attempts to deny the contradictory bind it has imposed on religious institutions. Thus, for example, in the Concordia report, it refers wishfully and vaguely to the, quote, many theological seminaries that are able to define and administer their doctrinal requirements without infringing on essential elements of academic freedom. But wishing does not necessarily make things so. There will arise in denominational seminaries of Orthodox persuasion those occasional hard cases in which the demands of academic freedom come into conflict with requirements of confessional adherence. What then? According to the standards established by the AAUP, to which it held Concordia Seminary, there can be but one acceptable outcome in such instances. Take an extreme but entirely imaginable example. According to the AAUP's understanding of academic freedom, an Orthodox Christian seminary would be required to allow a professor of systematic theology to teach his or her students, the future pastors in that seminary's church body, that the doctrine of the Trinity is an absurdity or that Jesus was neither the Son of God nor risen from the dead. Now one wonders if even the AAUP in all its serene secular assurance can really mean this, that it is truly that objectively hostile to religious sensibilities and religious commitments. Now, the Concordia case, for all its paradigmatic significance, is not by itself a fully satisfactory referent for the issues involved in the problems of academic freedom and the religious university. Start with the policy of the AAUP with respect to the interpretive history of the 1940 statement. One can imagine that a great many secular academics committed to the substantive view of the AAUP, that is, that there should be no religious restrictions on academic freedom, would nonetheless concede that the association's handling of the issue has constituted a bad faith exercise in semantic obfuscation that does violence to the meaning of words and to the reputation of the organization that allowed that exercise to proceed. A straightforward repudiation of the limitations clause would solve that problem, which, for all its current practical importance, is after all irrelevant to the central issues at stake on our larger question. There is also, and not at all incidentally, the distinction between a theological seminary on the one hand and a church-related university on the other. Most people would concede it reasonable to extend a more expansive definition of academic freedom to a University of Notre Dame, say, than to a Catholic seminary preparing men for the priesthood, or to a Valparaiso University than to a Concordia seminary. But here, unlike the case with the treatment of the limitations clause, the problem cannot be neatly solved. Just how expansive should that more expansive definition of academic freedom be? Should it be infinite? If not, where should the line be drawn? The first thing that needs to be said here, in my view, is that wherever that line is properly drawn, the decision as to the drawing of it should be made by the religious institutions involved and not by external groups such as the government, academic accrediting agencies, or secular representatives of the professoriate, such as the AAUP. Religious universities, we should remember, have academic freedom rights of their own. Professor Michael McConnell of the University of Chicago Law School has recently reminded us that the Supreme Court, in a 1957 decision written by Felix Frankfurter, acknowledged, quote, the four essential freedoms of a university: to determine for itself on academic grounds who may teach, what may be taught, how it should be taught, and who may be admitted to study. No professor, after all, is required to take a position at a religious university. And so long as the university lays out clearly in advance the restrictions it imposes, it should be free to interpret and apply rules of academic freedom according to its lights, which, to recall again, was the original position of the AAUP. But to settle the question of right is not at all to solve the problem of prudence or of wisdom. Granted that religious universities have the right to limit academic freedom, the question remains, to what extent, if at all, should they do so? The dilemma, for which no conclusive one-size-fits-all solution can be offered, stems from the religious university's dual nature as both a community of inquiry, Athens one might say, and a community of conviction, Jerusalem. A university, qua university, is involved in an endless and unfettered pursuit of truth, a pursuit originating in skepticism toward received truths, whereas religion, at least Christian religion, must, if it is to be true to itself, in some sense simply claim to be the revealed and unsurpassable truth. The community of conviction of religious faith speaks inevitably of orthodoxy and heresy. After all, no heresy, no orthodoxy. Terms inadmissible in the community of inquiry. Though, as an aside, I might note that the pathology of political correctness reminds us that even the most secular of academic institutions are not immune to the inquisitorial impulse. But this Athens-Jerusalem tension has, for a very long time now, tilted overwhelmingly in the direction of Athens. Richard Hofstadter noticed some 40 years ago that of all the themes in the history of American higher education, quote, the oldest and the longest sustained is the drift toward secularism, unquote. Scholars such as James Burchell and George Marsden have described in detail the process by which higher education in America, until well into the 19th century a function of the church, drifted more and more in the secularist direction indicated by Hofstadter. The general pattern, continuing into the present, has been from specific denominational affiliation to generic Christianity to generic religiosity to outright secularity. The dominant pressures of the modern academy point in the same direction. Faculty members at academically ambitious religious universities, socialized by their graduate training, focus their energies more on research than on teaching. As they do so, they tend to focus less on the distinct religious preoccupations of their institutions, since those preoccupations are more likely to be relevant to the classroom than to the highly specialized and particularistic tasks of scholarship. Similarly, professionally ambitious academics direct their loyalties more to the disciplines in which they work than to the institutions at which they happen to do that work. Their loyalty is to the scholarly guild and its standards and norms rather than to the concerns of their academic residents. Thus, duly socialized modern academics are inclined to insist that in matters like hiring and retention of faculty, nothing other than academic promise, as defined by the norms of the relevant discipline, should come into play. Intrusion into these matters of questions concerning religious commitment or dedication to the particular purposes of the institution come to seem at best parochial, at worst a betrayal of the academic calling. All this and more makes it difficult for religious universities especially those with academic pretensions, not to let their duties to Athens reduce to the vanishing point their loyalty to Jerusalem. The clear and present danger in most church-related universities today is not that they will give over the academy to the religious obscurantists and yahoos, but that in an incremental process so subtle and gradual as hardly to be noticed, they will give up the particular religious commitments for which they presumably exist. The point, and I want to emphasize this, is not that the Athens-Jerusalem tension should be resolved unequivocally in the direction of Jerusalem, but that it should be maintained, and that, so maintained, it will exist in a perpetual state of irresolvable and therefore unsettling uncertainty. For most of us, any university worthy of the name will remain a place where people are involved in deep and fundamental argument with each other. That is simply and gloriously the nature of the place. And few Christian institutions today will find frequent difficulty in letting the university be what it naturally is. Most versions of Christianity, after all, do not pretend to offer all-inclusive answers to all philosophical dilemmas and questions. They do not presume to moral or intellectual comprehensiveness. Most Christians, and I hope I'm not simply revealing my Lutheran biases here, would remain skeptical not only of Christian physics or Christian chemistry, but also of Christian economics, Christian history, or Christian political science. For most religious universities, in other words, most of their life and work, most of the time, will be carried on without questions of academic freedom ever arising. Yet, for almost any Christian confession worthy of the name, there remain certain fundamental issues of faith and morals, violation of which constitutes violation of the confession itself. When such issues and occasions arise, academic freedom cannot be in religious universities the trump it would be in secular institutions. And those of us who would argue for a very carefully restricted demarking of those fundamental issues are nonetheless required to respect the right of other Christians to define them more broadly. What should not be tolerated in a church-related university are faculty members for whom religious questions are matters either of contempt and ridicule or of dismissive unconcern. Religious universities justify themselves in the larger academic world by raising and contemplating questions that are not elsewhere engaged. An argument, one might say, for diversity, if that term were not so corrupted by current usage. And those who are not willing to engage such questions have no privileged place there. The hesitancy of most church-related universities to define academic freedom in terms relevant to their distinctive purposes stems from their thraldom to the reigning norms of the secular academy. And they are enthralled precisely to the degree that they aspire to respectability and prestige within the secular academic community. A Bob Jones University, after all, can maintain its radically sectarian independence because it does not care what the quote-unquote respectable academic community thinks of it. I would not for a moment suggest Bob Jones U as a model for religious universities to follow. But I would encourage church-related institutions to keep in mind its unconcerned independence of spirit. Although I did not think so at the time, I now agree with the president of Concordia Seminary, who, informed in 1988 of the AAUP's concern with the seminary's policy on academic freedom, told the association that its attitudes on the issue were entirely alien to the seminary's fundamental purposes, and that the seminary's internal affairs were, for that reason among others, none of the association's business. Religious universities need, if they are to confront the issues of academic freedom with neither defensiveness, obduracy, nor fear, a recovery of nerve and will. To achieve that, they need to come to terms with the history of church-related universities in America, a history of largely self-imposed subservience. The moral of the story of the decline and fall of most religious universities in this country is clear. The road from religion to secularity that most of them followed was paved with massive institutional forgetfulness and disastrous good intentions. The movement from religious commitment to secularity was the result most often not of any secularist plot, but rather of a fit of absence of mind, combined with a lusting after acceptance by the secularist academic establishment. Schools that had been born Christian, that had stayed Christian, that had assumed they would always remain Christian, suddenly awoke to find them that they were no longer Christian, or were so far down the road from Christian identity that it was too late to recovery. The historical record shows that the critical steps down the slippery slope to secularity were almost always initiated by administrators and faculty members who did not intend secularity at all. They wanted to improve their institution's academic standing, to move beyond sectarianism, parochialism, and church control in the direction of greater acceptance in the scholarly community. Almost all of the formerly Christian institutions that capitulated to secularity lost their religious identity incrementally and by inadvertence, not by one critical step or by conscious policy. The question of academic freedom for religious universities needs to be understood in the light of this history. The response to that history should not be one of defensive protectiveness, but of a certain serenity of conviction. The fundamental issue for the preservation of religious distinctiveness in American higher education is whether, given the message of modernity, any such serenity is still intellectually available. For those of us who believe that it is, who are persuaded that the secular Enlightenment model does not exhaust all authentic ways of knowing, the opportunities for religious universities to define their own norms of academic freedom may be seen not as negative requirements, but as positive occasions for affirmation of their distinctive visions and purposes. The religious university, after all, sets its own rules of academic freedom, not in order to restrict the pursuit of truth by those within its walls, but to affirm those higher truths that determine its existence in the first place. In contradistinction to the secular academy, the religious university's controlling norm is not radical individual autonomy. It is rather that suggested by C.S. Lewis. "I was not born to be free," Lewis said. "I was born to adore and to obey." It is in their freely assumed responsibilities to adore and to obey that religious communities and the religious universities they establish find their reasons for being. And it is in the light of their reasons for being, and without regard to the intrusions of the secular academy, that religious universities should set their policies on academic freedom. Thank you.
Mic trick. I wish I could say that I'm happy to be here, but I'm not. But when Richard called me up over at the dialogue office and told me how many people he had asked to respond to this paper and how many had refused, I felt an obligation to speak. I suppose one of my most significant, perhaps foundational, beliefs is in the importance of community. I am more moved by the notion of what connects us as a group of saints than by many of the other important theological concepts of our faith. Because of this, I think I am particularly idealistic about the interrelationships we form and function in as a church. I expect the best. I am again idealistic about our potential and perhaps our organizational potential. I think that when I came to BYU, I truly believed that this was the best of all worlds. What better environment to work in than one that was respected my Mormonism, that found my publications on Mormon history of value, important research to be treasured. I wanted to work in a place that at the same time respected my beliefs, my work, and my center. The idea of a church and a university blended into one in a seemingly idyllic way. Certainly all the ingredients are in place, but the community formed at BYU does not work for all of us. Perhaps my communitarianism, my idealism, perhaps even my residual 60s activism has caused me to demand more, or at least to expect more, because overall it just doesn't feel right. In some of my history classes, we often discuss a book called Time on the Cross by Fogel and Ingerman. This is a revisionist interpretation of the slave experience. It is a cliometric study, or a statistical analysis of the data taken from the notebook of a foreman of a southern plantation that had more than 120 slaves. In one section, they consider the idea of violence on the slave plantation, and then they say that there were, on the average, 80 whippings in a given year. Their conclusion was that what they call a limited number of whippings meant that the environment on the plantation was not nearly as violent as we had always assumed, because it was impossible for every single slave to have had a whipping. Now, I strongly disagree with that, what was considered at the time pathbreaking conclusion. For it seems to me that if there were, in fact, 80 whippings, or even if there were only 8, it would be significant. Each time a slave witnessed a whipping, regardless of how often, the very potent message was planted in his or her brain that this could happen to me. If I cross the line, if I disobey, if I look lazy, or perhaps even if I am simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, this could happen to me. And this realization would color everything they did, every choice they made, every attitude they expressed. They would never be able to breathe easy. Frequently, punishments meted out on the slave plantation were capricious, depending only on the whim of the owner, and didn't correspond to a sense of justice or of cause and effect. They didn't make sense in any way. They reflected only the arbitrary exercise of will. I don't think that it's an overstatement to say that this is the type of environment that currently prevails at BYU. And I don't know if it is fair to describe it as hostile. Certainly it is not violent in the same way. But there is something in the air that has sucked the life out of many of us, has discouraged longtime faculty members, has confused many of those of us more recently come to campus, and has morale at BYU at an all-time low. So of what is this mysteriously poisonous air made? The term academic freedom has become, down on campus, a catch-all for all that bothers us and has almost become devoid of meaning. Most specifically, it means the responsibility, obligation, or right to speak, express, create in the academic environment without restraint. Traditionally, academic freedom is associated with a questioning mind, attitude, and mode. It is perhaps the most basic assumption about a university environment. It is at the center of what we do. Interestingly enough, in this context, it has not had so much to do with what one says in the classroom. I agree with Rex Lee's statement that we do have the chance to express and discuss spiritual matters in a way that is very different, and I can talk to that because at the University of Utah, I was hesitant to talk about my spiritual feelings in a way that I was not at the Y. You can talk about what's inside your head and your heart in the classroom. But there are subjects that are difficult to address. I found feminism, for example, particularly challenging, although I always loved the really heated discussions that we would get in, so it turned out to be a good thing, not necessarily a negative. More than that, academic freedom also seems to imply a certain quality of life. It presupposes that there are different, perhaps different precepts that rule the university. And I don't mean that anything should go, although I am sure there are universities that closely approximate that kind of behavior. but a devotion to probing, constant, often difficult, but frequently delightfully challenging searching for answers to life's most profound questions about the nature of our existence, about the mechanisms of life, about the organizations and interrelationships of the world. I truly believe that the world is better because of the university experience. It has been 1 year since we first started talking about the Committee to Strengthen the Church, and 2 years since the public condemnation of this symposium. And since that time, there has been a malaise that has stunned many of us with its force and caused us to reconsider our relationship to the church, to the institutions for which we work, and perhaps even to one another. I was listening to NPR the other morning and heard an interview with a botanist who specializes in reforestation projects, particularly the reintroduction of the chestnut tree. She told of a plague which has attacked the Connecticut woods, the chestnut rot, which is killing chestnut trees by infiltrating the coarse bark and rotting out the central core. She is dismayed at this and said that she cries as she walks through the forest, seeing hundreds of dying and decaying chestnut trees, which are her particular favorite, being taken over by maples. Soon, she said, the chestnut tree will be a historical relic in the forest, and the forest will have lost some of their distinctive character. The interviewer said, but what does this matter? There are still many, many trees. It is densely populated even still. And the botanist said passionately that it is the diversity of the forest that makes it rich. It is not enough to have a large number of trees. Quantity is not what is important, but diversity. And here she moved from trees to people and back again. Diversity is what will save us. Diversity of character, of ideas, of contribution, of people, of trees. Diversity is what builds us up and makes us strong. And I agree with her. When I first came to BYU, I was happy to be there. I was struck by how much the same everyone looked. It seemed as if there were hundreds of students dressed in Gap Levi's, with blonde, permed heads, baseball caps. Whatever it was, there was a sameness that seemed to visually spread across campus, and I searched continually for the more eccentrically dressed child. And perhaps this is because my own teenagers so freely expressed themselves through their clothes. I wanted to see black faces. I wanted to see long hair. I hungered after sloppy, dirty, troubled kids, and I don't know why. My teaching method is what is generally known as the Socratic method. I feel comfortable in this format and feel that I learn as much from every classroom encounter as I hope my students do. Therefore, I'm charged up with an excitement as I approach each class and eagerly anticipate energetic exchanges of ideas. But it usually takes a while to train a class to feel comfortable with this, because it demands a respect for the unique contribution of every single sensate, carefully thinking, articulate, young and old person in the room. I always begin these classes by saying, I want you to know that there are not necessarily any right and wrong answers. Your insights are valued. I will be as excited by your challenges to my point of view as by your points of agreement. The process is what is important. I want you to learn to think. I want you to question. I want you to travel down the path of greatest resistance, the path of self-discovery, self-realization, but also the realization and awareness of the world we live in and the value of each diverse idea, concept, individual that you will encounter. A number of people have asked me over the past few months, what really happened to you down on campus to make you even consider resignation? And I am frankly at a loss at how to respond. It really is something that is in the air. What might be the monitors? I think if you peruse the symposium program, you will notice that there are only a handful of BYU professors in this year's symposium. That is a strong testimony to the environment down at the Y right now. I have heard from a number of older faculty members, as I've talked to them about my decision, who have said to me if they were in my shoes, they would do the same thing that I have chosen to do. And I've heard that the benefits office at the university has been flooded with inquiries about the possible consequences of early retirement. I think that, again, is a strong testimony about the environment at BYU. Last spring, the Counterpoint Women's Conference that was held in reaction to the rejection of Laurel Thatcher Ulrich as a women's conference speaker. 17 BYU women were on the planning committee, 17 students. The week before the conference was held, those 17 faculty members all withdrew from the conference. And all but one student, one very brave young woman, sat on a panel at that conference. This sort of self-censoring is damaging. It hurts each of us. Every time we make a choice out of fear, out of pressure, what are the long-term effects of backing down, of withdrawing, of biting our tongues? Well, I think it is a numbing paralysis of the spirit, perhaps eventually of the mind and certainly of the heart. Recently, one of my colleagues encouraged me to stay, and he said, "Fight it out. Take them to court if you need to. Fight all of our fight. We are with you. Something needs to be done." And I said to him, "So will you stand by me? Will you stand behind me? Will you support me?" And he said, "Well, it isn't necessary for all of us to put our careers on the line." Finally, I would like to address the issue of what I call a public-private dichotomy. I have frequently in the past 3 months heard critics of the firings at BYU say, "It's a private institution, they are free to do what they wish," and I agree. But if this is the approach which will govern future actions, it must become predictable, not capricious, not the exercise of the rule of men, but the rule of law. But most important, it must become candid. But even more central to this dichotomy is the issue of the relationship between the public life of the university and the private life of the individual faculty member. Because we are used to the church being an all-pervasive element in our lives, it is perhaps to be expected that we should feel comfortable in giving our lives away in the service of the institution. There is no line between private and public at BYU. What is an essential and beneficial dichotomy in regular life is devalued here. I think it must be reestablished. We must be able to own our own political viewpoints, party affiliations, and choices. So this becomes for me an issue of personal freedom or ownership of one's life. Last winter, I made a decision that I would go on the Rod Decker Take Two show, and perhaps it was a really stupid decision, but it was my stupid decision. And my decision to appear on that show belonged to me and to no one else. But the next day, many of my colleagues stopped me in the hall and said, "Have they called you in yet? Are you in trouble yet?" And I was incredulous. I couldn't understand why they would. But after a group of letters went to the First Presidency complaining about what they described as a brazen, frumpy BYU professor appearing on a program talking about feminism, I had to defend myself to justify that choice. And I thought that was overall a very humiliating experience. The intellectual, the faculty member, is portrayed publicly by church leaders as the enemy. And I think this seriously undermines our mission as professors of whatever discipline. It makes us suspect. And if we are feminists and so-called intellectuals, we are doubly branded. There is too strong a sense that devalues the contribution of the individual faculty member in relation to the mission of the university. I think this is very difficult to say, let alone to even really understand. The total value of the university is no greater than the cumulative contribution of the individual members. Each one of us makes an important and unique contribution that must be given proper respect and dignity. All these issues are at play in the environment of BYU. And this year the challenges came from different corners, unpredictable and sometimes not making any sense at all. Not unlike the whippings on the slave plantation. In Teaching American Heritage, a class I taught this last year that everyone has to take, we discussed the rule of law, tyranny, the Bill of Rights, And all the examples I could ever think up to illustrate these points came from my experience down at the Y. Despite the concerted efforts of the Academic Freedom Committee at the BYU, there is still no effective check on the arbitrary exercise of power from on high. No matter how good your record is in rank advancement, how powerful your evaluations, there's still a wild card. And no one can guarantee that the wild card will not be played. And the end result is the same. If you are a crummy, lazy teacher and you are rejected, or if you are a brilliant researcher and a moving teacher and you are rejected, it looks the same. And at that moment, the administration deserts you, many of your colleagues start to doubt your abilities, and you are set adrift. And this contradicts everything that I believe about community, and certainly what I believe should be true about the nature of a university. This is not just an issue for Mormon intellectuals, but every one of us who deviates from the center is the potential target of this same type of grasping for control. So finally, my prediction. There is a changing of the guard at the BYU. It is inevitable. This new generation of faculty members are looking at the world from a different perspective, and I am at the old end of it. They relate to gender issues differently. They are more activist in their orientation. They care about the quality of life. They will always be pushing for change. I believe it will be unrelenting. Removing Cecilia Farr and David Knowlton will not cure the problem. It will not ease the pressure. There will be waves and waves of pushers following behind them. The time of change is now. If a church engages in policies, practices, and even in a business or in an institution that it runs, that are wrong or unjust, it pollutes itself, it corrupts itself. I believe that the BYU will survive this latest controversy, although there are already serious casualties. But I hope that those casualties will rise like a phoenix and become a cleansing fire and help change to occur. Thank you.
Anybody else? We've heard two excellent presentations. Jim's balanced and thoughtful presentation of the issues from an informed perspective outside the Mormon community, and Marty's impassioned discussion of the state of affairs at BYU relative to these issues. I want to make a few comments right at the end, and then we want to take your questions for as long as we can. And I'm not sure that what I have to say measures up to either one of my predecessors on this podium, but we will see. This mic keeps going down. I hope I'm still being able to be heard. I'll try to be fairly brief. The modern... All right, that'll do. I'll hold it. Take the damn. There. Now we'll get it. The modern university is a product of the Enlightenment, with its stress on dispassionate analysis and the pure light of reason, which would supposedly reveal truth with clarity once all traditions, traditional opinions, beliefs, faith commitments, superstitions, etc., were subjected to its blistering light. This modern Enlightenment university, which is the paradigm university in the Western world, was conceived of as a sort of debating society, which careful consideration of all views would result in truth emerging, kind of popping up with lights on it. This university prized empiricism, rational, logical analysis of all opinions and beliefs and claims. It was distrustful of emotion, passion, and especially of prior commitments, whatever they may be. Faith commitments primarily. This university valued a serious, careful, dispassionate analysis in which truth is discovered. The Enlightenment's commitments to intellectual inquiry are, I think, for our purposes today and for the Sunstone Conference, best summarized or best visualized, if you will, in the Enlightenment's view of religion. The Enlightenment was, on the one hand, distrustful, supremely hostile to much of traditional religion. Where it wasn't hostile to traditional Christianity, the Enlightenment, this Enlightenment view of rationality, saw in Christianity, and particularly in the person of Jesus, or God, if you will, the rational moral teacher of a timeless morality that was fit for every person. The Enlightenment would have been horrified at the idea of God the Mother, or even God the Father. God, in the person of Jesus, was every person, a kind of rational, visual, symbol, teacher, example of a timeless morality. This is the religious teaching that you find in Rousseau's famous speech of the Savoyard Vicar. It's given its most brilliant statement at the hands of Kant in a book entitled Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. This sort of rational, every person sort of way of thinking about things. For the Enlightenment, the committed classroom, whether committed to feminism, to Mormonism, to Catholicism, to Afro-American liberation, that classroom, a committed classroom in which an essentially prior faith commitment shapes inquiry, influences and energizes the discussion, and it does do that, and at the margin, structures and maybe limits the final outcome. That kind of committed classroom, whether from the left or from the right, is anathema. The classroom should be a million debating society, committed to truth, and neutral and dispassionate and logical and rational in its pursuit. Now, the Enlightenment, it seems to me, is now undergoing serious question on both sides. On what we might call a hypothetical right wing, though I don't like the terms right and left, but they are convenient for our purposes. On the hypothetical right wing, though I don't think too far right, the Enlightenment is undergoing serious challenge from the resurgence of religious colleges and universities and their attempt to meld academic inquiry with a serious faith commitment. In the last 10 years, Catholic colleges have undergone a serious challenge in this regard. As a former teacher of theology at a great Catholic institution in New York City, Fordham University, I know the process well and the problems and the travails of that enterprise well. Catholic colleges in the United States have, at least the major ones, have all faced that challenge, have had new presidents or presidents that tried to re-energize the Catholic character of the college. And that was a serious challenge to this Enlightenment university as a debating society. It's also undergoing challenge from a lot of other movements within Christian theology. Most notably, I suspect, is what George Lindbeck has called post-liberal theology. And his colleague at Yale wrote a wonderful book about a decade ago, Nicholas Wolterstorff's marvelous, one of the great philosophical theologians, philosophers of religion in America, book which was exactly the counterpoint to Kant. Reason Within the Limits of Religion Alone, a kind of critique of the pretensions of the Enlightenment. But the other side is also criticizing the Enlightenment, what we might call left, the left critics, critics coming out of the Marxist or other traditions, postmodernism, feminism, critical legal studies in all of its various forms, Afro-American studies. These critics of the Enlightenment also want a committed classroom, a classroom with a purpose beyond dispassionate inquiry and logical analysis. They want a classroom that is committed to the liberation of women, to the liberation of Native Americans or Afro-Americans. They want a classroom that is committed to. What? We're going to have questions, and just as soon as I finish my finish making some final comments. But then it seems to me the question, and I do not have an answer for this: how can feminism and other left commitments, which have rejected the Enlightenment, ask coherently for the protection of the Enlightenment University and its premise of debating society, dispassionate, setting aside of prior commitments, and so forth? I think that may be possible. It is difficult, but it is possible. But it is much more difficult, and whether it's possible seems to me to be an open question, to unite forms, to unite one form of committed classroom, whether it be feminism or something else, with an institution whose commitments are different. And that, it seems to me, is the fundamental problem. Whether we can unite in one community different forms of commitment. Now, it seems to me that those who are struggling with this, those who want to try to make that work, must remember something that Bill Martin said yesterday in a fine paper that, if you missed it, you should get a copy. Orthodoxy defines communities, not dissent. Dissent is defined by its dissent from orthodoxy. And secondly, it seems to me that dissenters do not by themselves define the possibilities, that they must, those who seek a place at the commitment, must define themselves, must find themselves within the community. That is, they must show how their commitments and their teaching and their analysis is supported and sustained by the community itself. And I have a good answer for that. But it seems to me that those dilemmas of the Enlightenment University and the commitments of faith and other commitments of modernity are an essential tension which we have no good answer for. Thank you. We will take questions until no questions. All right, time's gone.